We are opening the mailbag in part one of our summer fun reader mail shows. If Le'Veon Bell isn't going to get paid, should he consider a position change? Also, Derek Carr's quick release, little tiny edge rushers, and why we don't see more hook and laterals. It's all on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. It is that time of year, summer fun. Mailbag. Nothing says summer fun like opening mail in a pool. We got lots of good questions, and I think we're going to do something similar to what we did last year. We won't blow it out into, what do we do, Andy? Like five 90-minute shows of mailbag or something absurd like that? I think they're going to
be short. Yeah, because we overpromised our listeners. We said we'd do every single question they sent us, and
yeah, we made a huge mistake. We won't do that again this year, but we are going to get to as many as possible. We're going to do, I'm going to guess, three mailbag shows here, but definitely this week and next week. So keep the questions coming if you have them. We'll get to as many as possible. All that said, let's jump right in, and we're going to start with Le'Veon Bell questions here because I don't know. There's some news around him. Let's see. First question, this is from Anthony here. Le'Veon Bell in all likelihood will be a coveted free agent next year, but he might find out that he's not going to make more than Todd Gurley, who of course signed his big contract last week. Bell has proven himself to be one of, if not the top back in the league, but last year he did not have a rush longer than 20 yards. Does he have to have at least one 50-yard run this season to convince other GMs of his value and truly maximize his next contract? I'm not sure. He did have a couple 20 plus yard runs, didn't he?
He means 30 yards.
30
he means
yards.
30
yeah,
yards
yeah.
there. Yeah.
Yeah. But Andy, does that change the way people view Le'Veon Bell if he breaks off a 60 yard run or two?
Yeah, I think it. I don't know if it would change it. People within the NFL have noticed that his longest run last year is 27 yards. And that doesn't mean the guy's slowing down. I mean, that very well could be coincidental. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of times that he had 3-yard runs that he turned into 12 and 15-yard runs. He is still, in my opinion, the best runner in the NFL. So he's not a fast breakaway speed type of guy. He's never really been that. A long run will help his value, certainly, because it has been noticed around the league. But really what separates him, and this is why he's hard to determine a value for, Todd Gurley, it's very clear what he is within the context of the Rams offense. Gurley's a fairly traditional running back who's very good on screen passes. Bell and what he brings as a receiver is what makes him unique. But that type of receiving prowess, that's not always conducive to everybody's offense. Not every team can just plug in Le'Veon Bell and all of a sudden have a great flex weapon that they put all over the formation. You have to have a scheme that allows for that, and a quarterback that can check you in and out of the right plays to fully maximize that. So Gurley, every scheme allows for a traditional runner. Not every scheme not every scheme has as much room for a hybrid weapon like Bell, and that could complicate things. And I honestly, I'm not convinced that there's a plan in place anywhere for 2019. I think the Steelers are taking this on a year-by-year basis because of Bell's injury history, a little bit of off-the-field stuff, and then they've put so many miles on him. He's only 26, yeah, but they've been running him so much. Why wouldn't they kick the can down the road and just take a wait-and-see approach with him?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest problem here, if we're looking forward to what Le'Veon Bell would get on the open market next year, and he won't get franchise tagged again, he will hit the open market unless they work something out beforehand, which they, I don't know, they probably won't. It's the mileage. It's the wear and tear he's taken. Obviously, a Gurley-type contract is not within question. If it's my team, I'd be very interested in looking at him on a 2 or 3 year deal. I think everyone prefer the shorter, the better with him. But he had 400-plus touches last year when you include the postseason. If he does that again this year, man, I mean, that's, you just look back historically, you're just not going to find many guys who can maintain that level of play for that, coming off of that kind of workload. So that's what he's facing here, and that's why it's really difficult to see him getting a a long-term deal. My expansion team in Hartford will offer him one, but I don't think anyone else will.
Well, and his patient running style does leave him a little less vulnerable to major blows because he's so in control and he can have that short area movement, kind of like Eli Manning. Eli Manning does not get hit very much in the pocket. He'll take hits, but he does not get blown up in the pocket. He is so good at contorting his body to absorb blows and make them glancing blows. Le'Veon Bell is a little bit similar in that sense. So his miles, he gets good usage of his miles. They're not taking as much out of him as other guys, but running backs, we've seen they hit that wall too. It kind of happens all at once with these guys.
Yeah, I'll throw this out as the almost the best case scenario for Le'Veon Bell if he is thinking about his long-term earnings. He suffers, let's say, a broken arm early in the season, misses, let's say, 8 to 10 games, comes back in December, arm is healed, and he just rips off a huge string of games in December and in the postseason, and people kind of say, oh, well, we'd like to bottle that going into next season, and since he didn't have, since he only had, 120 carries this year, we're not too concerned about the wear and tear now. But that's
kind of like the David Johnson is probably the most underpaid player in the NFL for what he brings and what he's getting. That's just a function of where he was drafted, and he's on his rookie deal still. Broke his wrist last year, so no mileage, no long-term damage. I'm sure he'll have that wrist. Wrists are very petulant, so I'm sure he'll have that for the rest of his life, but it's not going to impact his running ability. So you're kind of saying, and David Johnson's the only guy similar to Bell. You want Bell to go the Johnson route if you're Bell's agent, and you hope he's not in too much pain when he does.
Yeah, yes, there you go. Something, an injury not to his lower body that would keep the wear and tear off. And then if he's as good as he's ever been in this very specific scenario, if he's as good as he's ever been in December and in January, that gives people some to think about here. Because, ultimately, like we always say, these guys tend to sign these deals and they say they're 5-year deals or 7-year deals, right? The guarantees are loaded in the first 3 years. You see it with Sue. We saw with Julio Jones, who now got his contract situation settled. But before that, everything is loaded up in the first 3 years. 3 years of Le'Veon Bell, you get him until age 30. I could see someone talking themselves into that. And then the Steelers have to decide how good are we going to be without him, especially with the window closing on Ben Roethlisberger's tenure here. I do want to get to the next question, though, because it is in it's Le'Veon Bell here again, and I just think this is really interesting to throw around right now. This is Gertie from New Jersey. I'm a big Steelers fan and therefore a big Le'Veon Bell fan. All of his contract drama has been intriguing, and I had a thought about what the Steelers should do to keep Bell in Pittsburgh. Move him to wide receiver. He has clearly proven himself as a pass catcher and not just a runner. He could play much longer in the league if he wasn't taking 30 hits a game and would be just as impressive. I think he could have a longer career and still be successful if he was mostly a receiver but still ran the ball maybe 6-7 times a game. So let me boil that down to this, Andy. What if you took Le'Veon Bell and almost reversed what he does? He's still, you're still going to put him on the field. He's still a running threat. But maybe you're only going to run him, like already said here, maybe 6, 8, 10 times a game. You're going to use him primarily as a receiver. They have James Conner there who can be more of a bell cow back. But essentially, you get that you still maintain that running threat, but you are sort of further, using his receiving skills.
I think it's a good idea if you're playing franchise mode in Madden. I think in the real world, there are a lot of complications. One is what happens when you get into October, you're playing the Ravens, it's a big game, and everybody knows our best runner is Le'Veon Bell, our wide receiver. Are we really going to not run him in that game? Are the coaches in the heat of battle not going to call for Bell out of the backfield? I don't think they would be able to ultimately do it. That's one concern. The other is Bell's a tremendous receiver now, but he has the matchup factor. He's often running routes against zone coverage. He's running it against linebackers and safeties. he can line up on the perimeter, but as an every down threat there, I don't see him beating cornerbacks snap after snap. His route tree is not vertical right now. He runs routes 10 yards and less. So, yes, he's great at that, and he probably is second in value to – well, I put him behind Smith-Schuster now. He's probably third in value to Brown and Smith-Schuster as a pass catcher, but if you're expecting him to do everything those guys do, he might not be your third best pass catcher anymore. So I get the question. I don't think it's reasonable to make that a plan.
What if you could find that right ratio where he's what if it was 12 carries a game? What if James Conner ended up being a pretty good B plus runner behind Bell? You got Bell for 12 carries a game. When he's on the field, you still have to respect him as a running back. You still have to match up with him as a running back. But you're gonna use him less as a runner, let's say. Less. Not at all. Not going from, not 3 carries a game. And let's make this more interesting. Let's kick it. Let's say we're talking about like 2021 now. Like he's age 30. He's still in Pittsburgh and he's still done similar things.
But that eliminates the complicating part of the conversation is what do you pay him? Aren't we having this discussion to figure out how to pay him without running him into the ground?
They've come up with a year-to-year system and he's still going well. No one else was interested in him.
Okay. Sure. I mean, if it's make-believe, sure. And let's say also Ben Roethlisberger drank some special Gatorade and started aging backwards, and now he's in his mid-20s and the Steelers are great for the rest of time. Yeah, I'm all for that then. Sure. I mean, I guess I don't understand the parameters of this conversation.
Why don't you like my fan fiction? Yeah, I don't know. We'll move on then. This next one's coming from Dave McLean. Love all the position ranking shows, and obviously if you miss any of those shows, you want to go back and listen. They're just back in your feed. We did them all. They're done for 2018. Dave asks, which position group do you think has the biggest gap between your number one and number two picks? Edge with Vaughn, linebacker with Kuechly. Keep up the good work, guys. I usually don't read that part, but that's nice. I thought this would be a really easy question, and it was not nearly as easy as I thought it would be. Kuechly to Sean Lee, maybe Donald to Aaron Donald to Fletcher Cox.
No, I would go Kuechly to Sean Lee. That's the biggest gap between number one and number two at all positions.
We had a lot of good 1-2s, a lot of closely matched 1-2s here.
When did Aaron Donald become the Lord and Savior of defensive tackle? I know he's a great player, and he might be the most talented pure guy, but there's this talk around Donald as if he's J.J. Watt of a few years ago, and I think it happened because Wade Phillips said Donald should be considered for MVP last year, and everybody said, "Oh, well, that's look at that. If he's an MVP, he must be the best." I didn't have him first team all pro. I had Fletcher Cox ahead of him last year. Because Donald was part of one of the league's top 5 or 6 worst run defenses. Not saying it was his fault, not at all, but Fletcher Cox was the cornerstone of the league's arguably best run defense in Philadelphia. I just don't understand how Aaron Donald became such a Superman in everybody's eyes.
Well, I'll throw out 3, possibly 4 points. One, he's really good. Two,
I agree with that one. Yes, I agree. He is sensational. No one's arguing that part.
The disappearance of J.J. Watt caused something of a panic, and I think everyone's kind of looking for the next guy to sort of brand the dominant defensive lineman in the league. The Wade Phillips factor. Wade Phillips telling us all that we have to vote Aaron Donald MVP. And number four, the contract stuff. So he's constantly being discussed, and but is Aaron Donald get paid?
Yeah, okay.
What do they have to pay Aaron Donald? So he's always top of mind, I guess.
Remember a few years ago when, because Phillips coached J.J. Watt as well in Houston early in Watt's career, and he said, this was before J.J. Watt was J.J. Watt, he said he's a Hall of Famer. He's got Hall of Fame talent. Everybody said, whoa, wait, come on now. That's inappropriate. He's only played 1 year. So Phillips does have a good track record, and he doesn't say this about everybody. I get that, and he probably believes it too. He knows the value of Aaron Donald. There's just this mystique, though, about Donald that all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but has gradually built up. To me, it's a tad much. I think there are a lot of really, really good interior defensive linemen in the NFL, and Aaron Donald is one of them. He might be the best of them, but it's not a far and away discussion to me. It's a lot of guys in that conversation.
Can I back up to Le'Veon Bell one more time?
Well, I'm totally caught off guard, but if you'd like to, I suppose.
Would you say 3 years down the line, let's say Le'Veon Bell progresses as you think he will progress, maybe in Pittsburgh, maybe elsewhere. Let's throw the contract situation out. Let's say Le'Veon Bell is nearing his Adrian Peterson twilight. He's like age 32. Would you think he would be a viable option to move to wide receiver?
You're not letting this go. I thought you'd somehow tie this into Donnie. Like, you were really backing this up. We just basically reversed show. You're drinking that Ben Roethlisberger Gatorade.
I've still got Le'Veon Bell up on my – I didn't bring up anything for Aaron Donald's on my browser here. I still got Le'Veon Bell on the front here.
If Bell practiced receiver exclusively, he could maybe become a good slot receiver. Because remember, when you don't have to be fast to play wide receiver in the NFL, at least not inside, because the defense must react to you. So you set the tempo and pace. Le'Veon Bell, he saw this when Hines Ward was there. Hines Ward could barely run better than you or me, Gary, but he understood how to set people up. He understood body angles, positioning. Le'Veon Bell has always had that kind of spatial reasoning. The most interesting part of Bell will be how he ages in terms of balance. When you get old as a running back, LaDainian Tomlinson was a great example. We think your speed and quickness goes, and it does, but really what goes that makes the biggest difference, and it's so subtle, and this is why guys can watch themselves on film and not realize that they're declining. When they can see themselves on film not being productive still, your balance goes. Your physical balance starts to dissipate. And if you take Le'Veon Bell's balance out of the equation, he's not Le'Veon Bell at all. He is more dependent on balance than probably any runner in the league. So if his balance starts to go, what does he become, and when will his balance start to go? And I don't know the answer to that. It might go at 28, it might go at 38. There's no way to know that, and that's why it's hard to figure out his deal.
Okay, I'm closing my Le'Veon Bell tab on my browser, so he is officially off the table for the rest of the show, I think.
All right, it's a relief. He's got it by now. He's almost got to have a new deal.
Next questions come from Lorenzo. Why don't we have ultra-quick, smaller edge rushers for obvious passing situations? Those who can play slash will play special teams, safety, etc. On other downs, a guy like Shaquem Griffin he throws out there. Andy?
Well, I appreciate the question. I'm a little hurt because I can tell Lorenzo did not listen to this show, what, 2-3 years ago when we talked about Kyle Arrington of the Patriots?
Yes.
Lorenzo must be a new listener. It's a great question that he asks.
He missed this show 6 years ago when we talked about Kyle Arrington blitzing for the Patriots.
Well, it wasn't just blitzing, though. He was lining up in basically a wide nine position. It was like it was a blitz, but it was nothing disguised about it. He was – if you just had taken – the location of the bodies, you'd say Arrington was the nine technique. He was playing defensive end. If you just ignore what the bodies look like. So we've seen it before. It doesn't happen super often. I've wondered it myself, to be honest, but I think what teams do is try to strike that happy medium. For one, remember, third down and 11 is an obvious passing down. But if there is a run gap, you can still run for 11 yards on third down. And if you put a cornerback next to a right tackle or left to any offensive tackle, that cornerback's getting run into the ground, which is a free 6 or 7 yards. So that's the same as a catch and run effect, basically. So I guess my answer to that, unless it's third down and 25, and then by then most teams are just mush rushing anyway because they want to keep the QB in the pocket and force a check down, unless it's the most obvious of pack, you can only throw the ball, there's no other way, I don't think it's feasible, even though on the surface it seems feasible. Now, what teams try to do is find the happy medium, and that's why so many pass rushing specialists are 240-pound guys rather than 265-pound guys. So it's a smart question. I think teams would be more inclined to run the ball than people realize if they saw a light defensive end on third and long, because both safeties will be back deep on third and long as well.
No, I think it boils down to that. Most of your third downs are going to be like third and six, if we're talking third and quote-unquote long, third and six, third and eight.
You could not do it then. You can't have it then.
Yep, yeah, then you're basically playing 10 on 11. And really how much you have to prepare for third and, let's say, third and 14-plus situations or something like that. You probably feel pretty good about what you're going to do anyway, so why do something drastic and change things up?
Well, and it's totally different movement. If your receiver might be, or cornerback, he might be quick and twitchy, but you've got to skim the corner. You got to bend the edge. Your body's at a different angle. You're not coming from a square stance. A cornerback lines up with both feet planted in the ground, almost perfectly balanced. An edge rusher lines up almost the opposite of that, with his weight tilted really far in one direction. That's because of the geometry of turning the corner. So it's a different type of movement as well. So just because a guy is fast at one spot doesn't mean he would be fast or efficient mechanically at another spot.
This next one's coming from Jonathan. Andy has mentioned in the past that the Seahawks value left corner over right corner. Can you elaborate as to why that is? Do other teams running versions of that Seahawks scheme, 49ers, et cetera, feel the same way?
I've wanted to ask this question to coaches a bunch, and I just haven't gotten to it for whatever reason, because a lot of teams appear to value left corner over right, and you can tell the Seahawks do, because that's where Sherman played, and now Griffin, their best cornerback, mm-hmm. he's moving from the right to the left side, and they're not the only team that does this. A lot of teams do it. What I can think is offenses tend to be right-handed. When all things are equal and they set the strength of the formation, it tends to be more receivers to the right than to the left. Now, what makes me wonder about that, and if that's just so many people are right-handed, we do so many things right-handed, you don't even think about it, but I wonder if that's why it is, because a lot of times mechanically, on quick throws especially, it can be harder for a quarterback to throw quickly to his right than it can be to his left, because he's got to get his body more into that right-handed throw versus throwing against his body, which is naturally more balanced when you throw to the left. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't understand why offenses are right-handed. And the ball is usually on one hash or the other, and that determines where the receivers go. They go to the wide side of the field, not the right or left. But offenses have it in their minds. There's some part of human nature or something involved that leads everyone to kind of agree, hey, offenses tend to be more right-handed than left-handed, and maybe it plays out that way. I don't think it needs to play out that way. If I were running any kind of scheme, I'd find a corner who can play both sides, even if it's zone. And if you have a corner that cannot play both sides, that can only play one side of the field, you probably need a different corner then. So I would like to see more teams be matchup-oriented with their corners and travel guys.
Well, I would think offenses are right-handed, if I could back up slightly. I would think offenses are tend to be right-handed because your quarterback, I mean, your chest, your torso is facing to the right. I think it's just easier to – you have a more natural field of vision to your right side than you do to your left side.
Yeah, that's probably exactly what it is. But that doesn't – I don't know if that's a big enough factor. If the ball is on the right hash – so you've got a bunch of field space mm-hmm. to the left and less field space to the right. I don't think any coach would ever put their trips receivers to the right anyway because, well, the quarterback naturally opens his body to the right. I don't think it's – it might make sense, but I don't think it's a big enough deal that it ever becomes a factor. And again, I learned this when I was studying Derek Carr earlier this offseason, because he's a really good quick thrower. And his QB coach, who was Jake Peets at the time, was explaining to me how much work Carr has to do, how hard it is to get those quick throws out to the right. And Derek Carr is very good at them, and it's not just something that happens. Because when you're throwing, think about if you're dropping back and you're throwing immediately, right away, how easy it is to go left where everything's against you and mm-hmm. your weight is naturally tilted the other way. You can just kind of spin into the throw, versus to the right, if you spin into the throw, your arm's going backwards. So it's different mechanics. I don't know. Do you have any, I mean, your theory is a good one. Do you have any other ideas why corners would be a predominantly left side guys?
I just the vision for the quarterback, I think, naturally begins on the right for a right-handed quarterback.
And therefore the ball's likely to go right because that's where his eyes initially go.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I that would be my guess. I don't think that's a strong I don't think there's a good answer for this. I think it's just a human nature thing that teams could correct if they wanted.
Interesting. Next question here coming from Jared. We hear a lot about good offensive coaches creating defined reads for the young QBs, like the Rams with Sean McVay and the Eagles with Doug Peterson. Andy has also mentioned this in several recent articles. While I have a general idea what this means, can you give me a specific example of a play with defined reads versus a play without them?
Yeah, a play without them, just think of a spread 2x2 formation, so a tight end and a slot receiver on the left and the right side, and then a couple of receivers out wide, but outside of them, everybody just running routes. Green Bay does it a lot. The Browns did it a lot last year. Just spread formations, somewhat isolation routes. Those are not very defined reads. The quarterback has to some degree, every play is different, but they have to pick their matchup. Versus what the Rams do, they'll put their receivers tight to the formation and crisscross them coming off the line of scrimmage. So the guy who's out widest, he might actually be running the inside route, and the guy who's aligned inside might be running the out wide or the outside route. And the reason they do that is those looks distort the coverage responsibilities for the defense. And the beauty of it is when you get in those formations, you tend to get predictable coverages because you're controlling the spacing of the field, and so the coverage has to really respond to you as an offense. So you're Sean McVay, you can tell your quarterback, hey, when we get in this formation, we know that there's an 80% likelihood that the defense is going to be in this coverage. And the play is designed for if they're in this coverage, then your read is right over there. That's where you mm-hmm. go. So expect to go there, and if it's not there, here's your bailout option. And those are defined reads. So there's a very specific place that the QB's eyes need to go. And I know what the next question a lot of people have is, well, why wouldn't every team play this way all the time? And sometimes I wonder that myself, but it goes back to what your quarterbacks do well. Aaron Rodgers, for example, has such good field vision and such talent that you don't necessarily want to define his reads because you're constricting him a little bit. You're giving him handrails and forcing him to walk up a certain staircase when he might be able to use the whole atrium. So it just depends on who your guy is and how you play. When you have a young QB and the game is fast for him, defining the reads is a great way to slow it down because it gives him fewer things to look at. It gives him a way to isolate what he's looking at. It's a really smart way to play. And then when you're really special, you're Tom Brady and you can have defined reads without being prisoner to the defined reads.
That's atrium should be included in every quarterback analysis piece. That's a very good job right there, Andy.
I appreciate it. I will do my best.
But especially metaphor with the atrium.
What occurs to me now is Green Bay has the nicest atrium in the NFL. They just built that Packers Hall of Fame at Lambeau Field, and everybody says, I think they even call it the atrium, don't they?
Do they? I haven't been out there.
I'm pretty sure that
I don't know.
Someone on our listeners will know. But just picture Aaron Rodgers wandering around on the outskirts of Lambeau Field within the premises. He's between the parking lot and the stadium, and that little area there, that's where he's great, in that Packers atrium.
Next question is from Bobby. A recent PFF article on Derek Carr included this. Carr did continue to, quote, Carr did continue to excel in an area he has since he entered the league. Getting the ball out of his hands quickly and generally avoiding sacks. His 2.40 second average time to throw tied him with Eli Manning for the quickest release in the NFL last year, close quote. If the Raiders have a, and this is at this point, I assume, Bobby's quote, have a, quote, top three in pass blocking efficiency O-line, I would assume that would allow Carr more time to throw. Why did Carr get it out so quickly when he had such a good line last year? And is it really a positive stat? Eli Manning got it out quickly, I assume, due to an underperforming line. So let's back up quickly, because I know you're going to want to talk about the perception of the Raiders' offensive line, Andy.
You know me too well. You know me too well. Well, it's that whole release thing, and yes, Carr does have one of the quickest releases in football, and that means something. But that PFF stat that you hear about time for the release, that stat is really more indicative of the offense as a whole and how are they trying to play. The teams that line up and spread out and get the ball out quickly, and we just went back to that defined read versus not defined read, these non-defined read teams, so to speak, they play these spread formations, but here's the balance of it. What the Giants did last year and what the Raiders did, they spread out and threw a quick game, and that does tend to define the read a little bit more. The ball's out really quickly by design is the short answer to this, and part of the reason they play that way is because they know their offensive tackles really are not very good. So the tackles look good on the metrics because they don't give up sacks because the ball's out quickly, but the ball's out quickly because the coaches know better than to ask them to try to block and not give up sacks.
Don't give up sacks and pressures and et cetera, because people tend to yell at you that sacks are not the only thing that matters when you say sacks.
That's
sacks
correct.
In this case is shorthand for pressures, knockdowns, all that hurries, all that other stuff.
When you throw the ball on three-step timing, in theory, and you don't necessarily, it takes a lot of guts to try this, and there's not a lot of reason to try it, but in theory, you can leave a defensive end unblocked and the ball will still get out before he can arrive, as long as the quarterback plays exactly on time. Now, a lot can happen that can make a quarterback hesitate for just a split second, and in that case, then he's done for, which is why you still block the defensive end. But if you want to have your quarterback never get sacked, you can draw plays up that do that. They're just not all, they're not very expansive plays is the problem.
Assad from the UK. Think about Gary's point regarding teams tanking to get a favorable draft spot. May I suggest we tweak the way draft order is set? Instead of considering just the previous season standings, we take the average position of a team over the last 2 to 3 regular seasons. By this matrix, a team like the Raiders would have been picking in the 13 to 15 range. So a team must be consistently bad to move up the draft board. I'm all for blowing up the draft and the reward for teams with bad records, especially if we're not going to have the rookie wage scale. Or excuse me, if we're going to have the rookie wage scale artificially suppressing these contracts with the rookies. What do you think of that, Andy? What do you think about taking the fluke factor? I think back to the Cowboys the year they got Ezekiel Elliott. They had lost Tony Romo the previous year. That was before Dak Prescott, so they were playing Kellen Moore and Matt Cassel. They ended up having a terrible year. They were a good team that ended up having a top five pick. You know, they could have had Jalen Ramsey. They took Ezekiel Elliott instead, which that's their choice. But what do you think of that? Taking that fluke factor out, you lose your quarterback, you have the one down year. Now you get the quarterback back. You also get the top five player. Does this fire you up, Andy? This doesn't, does it?
I know what you're trying to. You want it to fire me up because
yes.
I think you think you've got the moral high ground in this conversation.
I do have the moral high ground.
I still haven't seen the I know that I'm not saying tanking doesn't exist. I'm not saying it hasn't been a discussion. It certainly has in other sports. I haven't seen it clearly and obviously not to a detrimental degree in the NFL. Dallas that year that Romo got hurt, they played Kellen Moore. Now, did they play Kellen Moore because, hey, he'll make us lose and we'll get a better draft spot? Or did they play Kellen Moore because, why not? We might find that he's somehow Tom Brady. Is he one of these lightning in a bottle guys? He becomes he's good enough, just enough that we can trade him for a draft pick. I think there's a lot of reasons teams play backup players in games that don't mathematically matter for them for playoff implications.
They stunk before Kellen Moore. All right. In regards to tanking.
You're selling in. Here we go.
I want you to get fired up on this. I think you're attacking me at an angle in which it's not an offensive that I'm taking here. I don't think tanking has happened. I think they are really, really inviting tanking with the rookie wage scale. I think they are tempting teams to a point where at some point in the next couple of years, someone's just going to say, we can look at this great quarterback coming out. We have a team that's probably a 6-10 team. All we have to do is lose a bunch of games, and now we're going to get this guy, add him to our 6-10 team. Now we're a 12-win team if this guy ends up being Aaron Rodgers or whatever it is. That's my issue with the way the draft plus the rookie wage scale is built. And I know people will yell, Jamarcus Russell, but there are guys in free agency who are also busts. There are plenty of guys across the league in various ways who have gotten paid and did not play up to their contract, if that's people's issue.
Yeah. Maybe the proactive solution would be to amend the rookie wage scale to bump up those salaries a little bit so that high first-round picks aren't so cheap, and then instead of a fifth-year option, make it a fourth-year option so that you have to pay these guys after 3 years. Because a lot of them, the guys that are going to be stars become stars by year three. Very rarely does a guy find his groove in the NFL when he's 27 years old and he's in the fifth year of his career, or even fourth year. Usually by now, by 2 to 3 years in, you know enough to know if he has a chance to be a star. Let's at least put it that way. And yeah, maybe you do that to make teams have to pay for those stars, because it is becoming a little bit unbalanced that the teams that have great rookie QBs, they get such an enormous salary cap advantage out of it. And then it raises the theoretical discussion, how much do we punish teams for having great veteran QBs? Should the Packers be at a detriment because they have Aaron Rodgers and they've groomed him, and the Rams have a huge advantage because they happen to have Jared Goff, who's much younger? I mean, these are all theoretical discussions, and it's the kind of thing that is worth going over when they redo the collective bargaining agreement expire soon, so they have to do a new one. I don't think it's going to be a priority, though, Gary, because we're not talking about the revenue sharing element. We're not talking about generating more revenue. We're just talking about distributing the revenue on paper, and neither the NFLPA, I don't know if they're going to care a whole lot about it, which maybe it makes it easier for the owners to fix.
I agree with you entirely. I don't think the Players Association really cares about this. I think they saw this as a plus when they put it in, even though it's not a plus. I think someone would have to point out to them, look, you are squeezing out sort of the capable journeyman player with this. The late 20s, early 30s guy who, if you had a fully free market set up, these guys would be in the league because they're better than whatever sixth round pick is going to, we saw the Rams do this. The Rams loaded up on day three picks, and they're just going to have these guys. So they'll throw away the junk, and they'll keep the two or three guys that they grabbed for 4 years on the dirt cheap contracts, even though they're slight downgrades from what they would have gotten from 31-year-old journeyman X at the safety spot or at the fourth linebacker spot or whatever. Though I feel like we should get back to Assad's original question. Would you support this, Andy? Would you support setting draft order based on not just previous year standings, but previous multiple year standings? I support it because I think it also it takes away the incentive for tanking a little bit more. Not that much, but a little bit more.
It's such an enormous change, and the draft system has worked so well, and the parity's worked around the NFL for the most part, that I know I'm taking a reactionary position rather than the proactive position, which probably makes me perfect for an NFL front office job on Park Avenue, but I would need to see bad evidence of tanking first in order to do this. So far, it still hasn't happened for a variety of reasons. It hasn't happened, the tanking. So I would not radically change the draft. I would change the rookie wage scale and shorten the contracts for draft picks, probably all guys. Second-round picks and beyond, three-year deals. First-round picks, three-year deals with the fourth-year option.
Okay. So you're going to be reactive instead of proactive. I want everyone to remember that come November election time. Next one's from Dante. Why don't teams run offensive plays that incorporate a pitch option, like down the field, for example, the hook and lateral play? I love a good hook and lateral. And why don't teams do it more? I'd love to see it more.
I think it's a great question. I do think we will see more of it, not in the near future, but maybe way down. I think it's the futuristic side of football, is making teams defend multiple parts of the field after the play has unfolded. The Rams actually did this last year at times. They had some built-in hook and lateral stuff. Cooper mm-hmm. Kupp was involved. It gained about 10 or 11 yards, I think, both times they did it. I think it is eventually going to be here as something you see, maybe like a read option kind of deal where you see it four or five times a game, just enough that teams have to defend it. The hard part of it is if you're designing plays, the whole idea of designing plays is balancing and spacing out the field, making the defense defend that entire 53 and 1/3 yard width and then the 100 yard depth. You've got to make them defend all of that. So you do that by spreading everybody out. Well, if you're doing hook and laterals, then you almost have to reverse course and go in the different direction and figure out how can we get guys to unspread out, because you got to be near each other to pitch the ball back. You're not going to throw it across the field. So that's the challenge. Someone will figure out some way to do that, because that's how things evolve. I do think we'll see it, but we might both be retired by the time it's here, Gary.
Yeah, it's also got to get to a point where teams don't fear turnovers the way they do irrationally, to an irrational extent like they do now. Maybe that will come back into
it. You think it's irrational?
I think it has become irrational. No one's pro-turnover. No one's saying, oh, I like turnover. Oh, it's fine if we turn over seven times today. I just think the league in general. So this is what would happen. If someone ran, let's say the Rams started doing a hook and lateral three times a game, next year, let's just fast forward, move the timeline way up next year. If one of those resulted in a fumble and then they lost the game by a field goal, it'd be Sean McVay is an idiot. Fire Sean McVay immediately. Maybe not quite to that extent, but people would be up in arms about it.
But, and here's how, but the smart teams would understand that a coach like McVay or any coach, there's a fumble, it's a bad thing, but in the process of doing it so often, we've discovered, A, it can work some of the time, but B, now defenses have to defend it. And the mm-hmm. way they, what they have to do to defend it, we can exploit that with our regular play designs now.
Do you have an owner who can block out all the negativity that will come in from a fan base? That, I mean,
we could have that discussion now.
Yes.
Owners that can block that out and let teams run their program, the Pittsburgh Steelers with Mike Tomlin, and it helps that they win, but it's a chicken or egg thing. Are they winning because the owner gives the coach freedom, or are they winning because the coach has freedom because it's a good organization? We don't know. But if I were an NFL owner, I would be extremely hesitant to make a head coaching change. I might change my GM at times. That's a different kind of job completely. Mm-hmm. But coaching continuity to me is an enormous factor in NFL success. And the Panthers are a great example. He's not an owner anymore, but Jerry Richardson was very patient with Ron Rivera. And Rivera was 7-9 a couple of times. He was a classic hot seat guy. All of a sudden, without making big changes, they had the same roster, same QB, same guys around them, same defensive core. That perennial 7-9 team with the hot seat coach, they went 15-1 1 year and almost won the Super Bowl. So you give teams time to do the same thing over time, they're going to become better at it, and they're going to become better football teams.
Yeah. This conversation could take up like a 20 minutes of a show, but the pressure that owners feel, rightfully or not, in most NFL cities, I think, is a big deterrent to that. I always think back to, remember when Bill Belichick went for it on the 4th-and-1 from his own 20 in Indianapolis on Sunday Night Football. They didn't get it. Colts get the ball back. I can't remember if they got a touchdown or a field goal to win it, but basically that fourth and one deep in his own territory in a game that was either tied or they led. I think they were leading slightly. That, you know, because it's Bill Belichick, everyone, you know, whatever, we talk about it for a day, but it's Bill Belichick. He's not losing his job over that. But if that is, third year coach X, whose team has maybe made the playoffs once, it's a different conversation.
Well, maybe Doug Peterson just did it in the Super Bowl, though, and he's in his second year, and he went but he went 7-9 his first year and did it a bunch, and it didn't work, which is part of the reason they were 7-9. And he's in the hostile Philadelphia sports market there, and it works the next time around. So, I know I hear what you're saying, but the Eagles got it right by letting Doug Peterson's coaching all out as if he is Bill Belichick and has lifetime job security, and it's working for him. If he didn't feel like he had ownership's backing, would he be coaching that way? And if he weren't coaching that way, would Philadelphia have won with Nick Foles last year the title? I bet the answer would be no on a lot of
probably
those questions.
Not. Yeah. I mean, that's more owners should be like that, but they are, I think the vast majority are not. And we are a society that reacts to anecdotal evidence and symbolic moments and things like that. And all it takes is one to sink a guy in most cities with dumb owners. That's a wrap for this show, though. Thanks, as always, to producer Shelby Royson, as well as all the good folks at Canes 13 who make us sound so good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You really are the best. Mailbag shows coming up, so keep those questions coming. Talkback at themmqb.com. Put podcasts in the subject line. Andy_Bonite, G Grambling_SI on Twitter or Facebook. Send us those questions. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, and of course our show, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.